will call the docket.
Board of Supervisors of Loudoun County and State Corporation Commission et al. And David I. Ramadan, and State Corporation Commission et al. Michael J. Conan, E. Ford Stevens, Leo U. Rogers, Jr., and Loudoun County Attorney, William S. Stanley, Jr., Aaron B. Allen, City of Palace, John F. Dudley, Andrew D. McGill, Robert M. Long, Timothy E. Miller, City of Palace.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Leo Rogers. I am a Loudoun County attorney. Along with Mike Quinnen, we represent Loudoun County. Aaron Couchins is here representing former delegate David Ramadan. This case involves the investigation of toll rates on the Dulles Greenway. Virginia Code Section 56-542D controls. It sets the standards. The toll rates must be reasonable in relation to the benefits obtained, must not materially discourage the use, and provide the operator no more than a reasonable rate of return. The duty of the commission is to protect the traveling public, to make sure that this public service corporation company operates the Greenway and complies with these standards. It is our contention that they did not do so. The Greenway is the only private road in the Commonwealth. It is an expressway to the interstate through Northern Virginia and to the nation's capital. It runs through Loudoun County, the wealthiest county in the United States, has the highest growth rate here in Virginia, one of the highest growth rates in the state, and is one of the economic engines of the Commonwealth. Greenway, being that straight shot, is the fastest, most direct way from one point to another. It's a divided highway. No stop lights, stop signs, none of the normal interference that you would get on the local roads. And that's why it's able to have a toll on the Greenway. Yet Northern Virginia drivers prefer to take the congested roads as they look down on a two, four, or six lane Greenway on a 10-lane right-of-way that's being underused. In addition to materially discouraging the use, because the Greenway raised its tolls by more than double and had a 25% reduction in use, the Greenway actually raised more revenue by increasing its tolls and reducing the number of customers. TripClue2 claims it didn't get an unreasonable rate of return because it didn't pay its investors money. And that's the finding that the commission made. Our position is that is a subjective finding to this company. And the General Assembly intended to have a more objective standard as to what reasonable rate of return means. I'd like to first address the burden of proof. The county is a participant in this case. We did not initiate the investigation. Former Delegate Ramadan, filed the complaint, but the investigation is initiated by the Commonwealth. We are voluntary participants in the case, and yet the hearing examiner placed the burden of proof on us. We contend that that's wrong. The burden of proof should have either been placed on the staff or on the company itself. Analogizing to other State Corporation Commission investigations, the rules place the burden of proof on the staff. I understand those are adjudicatory procedures. This is the first time that the only road in the Commonwealth has been investigated. It's a case of first impression. So by analogy and by logic, the burden of proof has to be on either the staff or upon the company. In a rates case under utility rate making, the burden of proof would be on the company to justify the fact that its rates are correct. Both Delegate Ramadan and the county objected to having the burden of proof placed on them. And what we said was we objected the burden of proof is on us. The burden of proof needs to be on someone, but it doesn't have to be on voluntary participants to the case.
Counsel, didn't the commission say that it did not determine the burden of proof? That it looked at all the evidence and it, in fact, acted as the fact finder without a burden of proof? They just reviewed the evidence.
Yes, that is correct. And
so what the hearing examiner said isn't what we're looking at today. We're looking at what the commission said.
The commission, yes, you are correct. The commission said that that it is not placing a burden of proof on any of the parties. Logically, the burden of proof needs to be somewhere, but the commission did state that. However, the whole proceeding was held with the county and former delegate Ramadan having that burden of proof. All the findings in the hearing examiner's report, which are cited by the commission throughout its order, were done under the contention that we had the burden of proof and the factual findings that the hearing examiner made based on that mistake.
May I ask you another question? Doesn't subsection I presuppose the floor? Because it seems hard to understand how the relationship between D and I isn't an apparent legislative compromise. And if it is, then the notwithstanding language has got to be given some meaning. What meaning does it have if it doesn't have the meaning that the concurring commissioner gave to it?
Your Honor, that was the decision of one of the commissioners that I preempted paragraph D. That was not the ruling of the entire commission. The General Assembly, in adopting that code section, added subparagraph I as part of the whole code section, which included subparagraph D. I was intended to increase the base toll rates based on a set margin of inflation or taxes. But there still is the base toll rate. So an investigation under subparagraph D, which is what happened here, is an investigation into those basic toll rates. The toll rates need to comply with subsection D. There is no indication that the General Assembly intended to use an inflationary rate to an illegal rate and preclude an investigation under subparagraph D. In fact, nowhere in the legislative history or on the face of the ordinance is that contained. And this
Counsel,
court,
can I ask you a question on following up? Those original rates, prior to the ones that were adopted pursuant to subsection I, were adopted by the commission many years ago. There was no appeal of that order, and it was stepped. I believe it was a stepped order. And as they were implemented throughout the years until this complaint was filed, I believe, what, in 2012? When was this complaint filed? Like the letter 2012. There was no consideration that they were wrong and didn't comply with the. So why now would you have the right to come in and challenge something that was adopted many years ago?
Thank
you.
You
didn't challenge it then.
And that's a critical point. As part of an investigation into the base toll rates, it's axiomatic that the toll rate would first have to be approved by the commission in order for it to be in place. When the toll rate was put in place, there was a dramatic decrease in the number of users. That continued for a period of time. There were complaints from citizens. Delegate Ramadan took the initiative of making a formal complaint to the commission, which initiated the investigation. So you'd have to first have a toll rate approved by the commission in order to have an investigation of that toll rate. In 2006, as the record reflects, it was based on a market-based analysis. When this case was heard, it was based on an elasticity study. Those two are very different components of how the rate was set and why the rate was set at what it was. So the paragraph D has to apply to a rate that's already in place, and it was just at this point that the investigation was conducted. If I may return on paragraph D, this body considers all parts of the statute to have meaning, and that there's a presumption given to the legislation that the court will presume that each part of the statute has some effectiveness.
Can I interrupt you again? I'm sorry, and I don't want to derail your argument on this point, but can you specifically answer only the narrow question of what does notwithstanding any other provision of law mean from your perspective in I? What other provision are we trumping out of that language if it's not the implied trump of D?
Yes, sir. Paragraph I deals with the procedural issues of how you would do a toll rate increase based on inflation. There's a different standard that's set. And there's no indication that, notwithstanding any other provision of law, meant that the General Assembly intended to preempt not just paragraph B, which is contained in the statute, but all other provisions of law when it comes to the legality of toll rates. What it meant to do with that was to create an expedited process where the Commission shall approve rate increases based on inflation and taxes.
So using the escalator in I would have been an unlawful exercise of authority because the authority didn't exist or because it contradicts some other statutory scheme that the notwithstanding principle or clause needs to be plugged into?
What the notwithstanding language would mean is that the Commission shall not go through its normal process of review, increase the base rate by the amount set in the statute upon application.
Okay, so it's just changing the default of where you do increases.
That's correct, okay. for an inflation rate.
Fair enough.
I'd like to return to the issue of materially discouraging use. The protection of materially discouraging use is a finding by the Commission that the Greenway is not a public utility, does not have a monopoly with respect to transportation routes used by motorists, and is subject to competitive pressures. This ignores the statutory regulatory scheme adopted by the General Assembly. The Commission found that there were alternative routes, and therefore the Greenway was subject to competition. I just drove down I-95 and got to see the expressway where people were paying tolls instead of going on I-95. The alternative routes already existed when the legislation was adopted. Those alternative routes existed when the Greenway got its initial charter and when the toll rates were increased. Yes, there have been improvements to local roads, but that's also caused by the fact that 25% of the customers of the Greenway stopped using it and started using the congested local roads. That's in the fastest growing jurisdiction in the Commonwealth. Instead of the use of the Greenway going up, the use of the Greenway went down. And so that's the monopolistic practice that the Greenway has. It has an asset that is different than local streets. We drive local streets. We know that pedestrians are on the streets. We know there's stop signs. We know there's traffic, low speed limits. When you want to get from one point to the other, you're willing to pay a rate, but that rate needs to be reasonable. And the materially discouraging use was ignored by the Commission because they found, contrary to the intent of the General Assembly, that this was just a business subject to competitive pressures. If that's true, then the Greenway can continue to raise its rates, as it has done here. It can have a doubling of the rates and a 25% reduction in the number of customers. The Greenway makes more money, and they will materially discourage use with the toll. The General Assembly had to mean something more objective. A 25% reduction in tolls is not only material, it's significant. You can't have 100% reduction because that wouldn't make sense from a business standpoint. As in a monopolistic
practice. Counsel, why wasn't this just a battle of the experts? You had a very able, qualified expert, as did the other side, and the Commission parsed that and just didn't accept the one testimony and accepted the other. So how do we, as a matter of law, say, well, that's just wrong?
This is definitely, on a fact-based investigation, there's facts are certainly going to be critical to it. Also, the tests that the Commission used are critical. In this case, the test that the Commission used is that they don't need to regulate the Greenway as a public utility or as a monopoly because it's subject to competitive pressures. They used examples of alternative routes. Alternatives exist to other public service corporations. An electric company, you don't have to use all the power from an electric company. You can use solar power. You could have geothermal. You could. It's going to be far more expensive and far more inconvenient. Just as inconvenient as it is to drivers in Northern Virginia to have to spend their time in traffic, just as expensive as it is for them to waste their productivity because they can't be on the Greenway, just as expensive as it is to the Commonwealth of Virginia to have to improve those roads because the Greenway is being underused because their toll rate is materially discouraging use. So, yes, sir, it could be a battle of the experts if the correct standards were being applied. I'd like to go to the reasonable rate of return. Here the commission stated that the reason there was not an unreasonable rate of return was because there was no return to the investor. This goes back to the fact that they don't need to regulate the Greenway as a monopoly or as a public service corporation. Public service corporations provide public services to the most citizens at the least cost. Here we have a public service corporation providing services to fewer citizens at a higher cost. That's contrary to the statutory scheme.
But actually, the commission's findings were broader than that. They said it wouldn't provide sufficient revenues for Trip 2 to meet its debt obligations, wouldn't allow them to recover operational maintenance costs, and could jeopardize the overall financial integrity of the company. Isn't that right?
That was a finding that the commission made with regard to the rates proposed by Delegate Ramadan. And in that, the commission indicated that the rates proposed by Delegate Ramadan would not provide enough of a return for the Greenway to meet all those obligations. I agree that the commission should be looking at the operating costs of the Greenway, should be looking at its debt, should be looking at return, if any, to investors, to determine whether or not the return they're getting from the tolls meet their business obligations. That wasn't done. The commission focused mainly on the return to investors, and the return to investors is more of a subjective test, and it's our contention that the General Assembly meant a more intensive test be applied. The code allows the staff, given that the staff might have the burden of proof here, to subpoena the records, audit the books, and review the tolls on the Greenway. That would determine whether or not it was a reasonable rate of return to the Greenway. It's reasonable in relation to the investment that they have.
So you disagree with the methodology by which they came to these conclusions?
That is correct, yes. The finding that the General Assembly presumes that public service corporations should not be subject to an objective test is just contrary to the statute and would allow the Greenway to continue to raise its tolls without having to be subjected to the statutory scheme. Similar to any other monopolistic practice, it's going to raise those toll rates until it stops getting a revenue from the from use of the Greenway. At this point, I will turn it over to my co-counsel. I see I did not leave him much time.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Aaron Houchins, and along with William Stanley, Jr., I represent Delegate Ramadan. I want to touch on 2 points in the limited time. I believe Mr. Rogers touched on a lot of these. The first point goes to the question of whether or not under subsection I versus subsection D, that subsection D allows a review of the tolls, and we would submit that it does. And I think an example highlights the fact that it can harmonize that statute. For instance, let's say that there was an automatic increase under subsection I, and then the toll trip company refinanced their debt and had less debt obligations moving forward. If they never made that application again, The subsection D sets up a procedure by launching an investigation where you can review the rates to see if they're reasonable at that time and under what's going on in that situation. So I think there's an easy way to harmonize those two sections.
So what I give you, D can take away?
Essentially, D allows for review of what I can give you. And I doesn't necessarily mean you have to use it. It just, if you do use it, then it gives you the lockstep kind of increase that's set forth.
Seems like a very awkward way to set it up. It may be right. I'm just...
It may be awkward, but it's what the General Assembly gave us. In interpreting the statutes, I believe we need to look at and try to harmonize. I think that's the best harmony that we can reach, is that if you get an increase upon an application under I, that can still be investigated under D, which is what Delegate Ramadan, former Delegate Ramadan, was asked to do here. And so I think that example is can harmonize these two statutes and doesn't necessarily mean that this investigation couldn't occur.
Well, counsel, wouldn't that make sense if the word was may or in some way was saying that if you give an increase, this is what it has to be. It doesn't really say that. It says that they shall give this increase. Oh. And what you're saying is you have to do it, but then you can go back around and see whether or not you should have given it.
You only have to do it if there's an application made under subsection I. If there's no application made and the rates continue, it then sets up a way for you to review those rates in the future if there's a necessary mechanism to call for review of those rates. So again, if there's a refinance, use that example, a refinance of debt that drives down the debt service obligations, then if you come back and review it under D, there may be a reasonable rate of return, or there may be something there that allows you to that would call for a substituted rate under D. So there's an I process and a D process. I see that. I've got a red line.
All right. Thank you very much.
Hey, it pleases the court. My name is John Dudley. I'm with the State Corporation Commission, and I'm sharing time with Trip 2 today. Every action that the commission took in this case was within its authority under the statute, and it was supported by evidence and the record. I want to first start with the statute. Under 56-542D, the commission has very broad discretion with whether or not to substitute new tolls. In fact, that statute doesn't require the commission to substitute new tolls under any particular circumstance. Rather, it says that the commission may substitute new tolls if it finds that the three criteria in D have been met. And the commission has done that in the past. In 2007, for example, under 542D, the commission established tolls, substituted new tolls increases that would go into effect between 2007 and 2012. At the end of 2012 and beginning of 2013, Delegate Ramadan sent letters into the commission asking the commission to initiate an investigation under D as to whether or not the Greenways tolls continued to meet the statute. And so the commission did that. The commission issued an order and initiated an investigation and asked the parties to address whether or not the Greenways tolls continued to meet the three criteria in D. And at the end of the investigation, the commission exercised the discretion it has under D and chose not to substitute new tolls. And the commission made very specific findings to support that decision. First, the commission found that the Greenways tolls continued to meet the three criteria in 542D. Second, the commission made separate, independent findings on Delegate Ramadan's proposal under 542D. The commission found that Delegate Ramadan's proposal would jeopardize the financial integrity.
Can I ask you just a couple of quick factual questions? What did this road cost to build?
Oh, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I don't have that answer. It opened in 93. And
where this is going is, it seemed like it was the leverage levels were fairly extraordinary. So it cost X amount to build, and there's this huge amount of debt. That was my impression from the record. And then we say, well, but you have to service the debt, and so therefore, and it just seemed anomalous.
What I am aware of is that when the road was first approved, that tolls were set low enough so that there'd be traffic, and then at some point, Trip 2 could not meet its debt obligations and had to restructure and refinance its debt. And that actually goes into part of our argument under, in this case, when it requires the commission to regulate them as a public service company, the way the commission has applied that is that means Trip 2 has to get the commission's approval before taking on new debt. So the commission approved these new debt obligations were acquired by Trip 2 with the approval.
So there's been oversight all along
correct.
The way.
There's been oversight. The commission had to approve that debt.
Thank you.
Council,
could I ask you a factual question, too? The tolls, however, that the commission was studying in this case, was looking at, were those tolls adopted in 2013? Is that correct?
The final increase under the commission's 2007 approval occurred in 2012. Mm-hmm. Then under 542I, the tolls continued to change during the course. But the tolls that were started to be looked at were the final ones that were approved under D in the 2007 proceeding.
So it was, in other words, only D-approved tolls were the subject of this investigation, even though they have increased under I in 2013, 14, 15, 16.
Right, and we cited in our brief all the times we have increased since the approval in D. And I acknowledge the issue what would the commission do on remand? What would the I creates with that, since I only have one commissioner that spoke to that, the D not preempt I. And TRIP 2 will get into the argument because I'm aware, we recognize the court can affirm the commission for a different reason.
Interrupt with another question. I'm just conceptually, I'm struggling with the thought that you can have an adjudicatory review, or for that matter, even a pure investigatory review, without a burden of proof. I mean, every fact finder, every decision maker, every judge knows that there's a margin of doubt in everything. And you have to assign the margin of doubt to somebody. So I'm just not understanding conceptually how the commissioners would say, we didn't assign it to anyone. They would have to be 100% certain of every single word in their decision making for it to be irrelevant to whom the margin of doubt was assigned.
I'm certainly answer that it's not adjudicatory.
Right, I got that.
Okay.
It's investigatory. But if you're trying to make a finding, if you're trying to figure something out.
But I wouldn't even say investigatory. I would say the commission has adjudicatory and legislative powers, and this was a legislative proceeding. And the commission, Delegate Romanoff sent letters asking the commission to initiate the case. So the commission was initiated on its own.
I don't want to get into the weeds of the particular function. I'm just meaning for anyone making a decision, whether it's the government or a mom and dad, there's going to be some margin of insecurity as to your confidence. And the courts, since the beginning of the common law, says, yeah, we know what to do with that. We find a party and attribute that risk to them.
And my answer, not to repeat myself, is that it wasn't making a decision in its stance as a court, but as a legislative function. And when the commission makes the legislative function types of decisions, this does become, and I was going to get to, a battle of the evidence, a battle of the experts. The commission weighs evidence put on this by this expert, evidence put on by this expert. This court has said that's the commission's duty to take what may be conflicting evidence, and beside cases in our brief, weigh that evidence and make its own findings. So when Delegate Ramadan and Loudoun County both asked the commission to find, and we cited in our brief, that no party had the burden of proof. That's what they asked the commission to find, and the commission said, okay, we'll agree with you. We initiated the investigation. We're not going to give any party the burden of proof. We're going to take the evidence in the record, weigh it in our legislative function, and make factual findings under the statute. When I was listing the separate independent findings on Delegate Ramadan's proposal, I was going to go through four of them. The second one was, when I got the question about, they found that his proposal didn't allow them to meet the debt service obligations that had been approved as prudent by the commission. The commission also rejected Delegate Ramadan's claims that TRIP 2 had acted imprudently, and the commission rejected how Delegate Ramadan proposed to calculate a return under 542D. So based on his findings, the commission decided not to substitute new tolls, and that decision was fully within its discretion under D. Assignment 2 was the burden of, make sure I save time for the other counsel. I think my argument is the same as my answer to your question. Then that gets me to assignments 3 and 4, and those are the two assignments that assign error to just two of the commission's factual findings in this case. The first, for assignment 3, the commission found that the greenways tolls do not materially discourage use. And that finding is supported by evidence in the record from two expert witnesses, one for TRIP 2 and one for the commission staff. Both of these experts performed regression studies. The purpose of these regression studies were to isolate the effect of the prior toll increases that had been approved by the commission. Both of those witnesses found that the prior toll increases had only resulted in statistically low rates of diversion for purposes of a toll road. Delegate Ramadan's witness put on evidence to suggest that use had been materially discouraged, but this is the discretion the statute requires the commission to implement, to choose what evidence it's going to rely upon, and the commission chose the evidence that didn't look just at aggregate numbers, but focused on the effects of the toll run. The effects of the toll increases, and not, whereas Delegate Ramadan's witness, the commission said, included other effects, other things that could have changed the usage of the toll. But I'm starting to babble, and I want to get to what this witness has found. They found that for every 1% increase in the toll, there was only a 0.1 to 0.3% decrease in use. So that evidence supports the commission's finding on assignment 3.
So if that were the monopolistic practice, it was a pretty poorly executed one under that logic.
Well, if you the monopolistic, the inelasticity of the analysis ignores the standards under the statute that the commission has to apply. This not materially discouraged use standard, the General Assembly wrote a standard that assumes that tolls will be able to go up without materially discouraging use. That's how the statute's structured. And now I want to get to assignment 4 before I sit down. And for assignment 4, the commission explicitly found what was required under the statute. The commission explicitly found that trip 2, the operator, was getting no more than a reasonable return. The commission cited in a footnote, I think it's footnote 23 in the commission's order, some of the evidence that supported that finding. The evidence cited in that footnote includes evidence from both Trip 2 and the commission staff that speaks directly to the Greenway, to the operator. It shows that the Greenway has never operated at a profit, and Trip 2 has never earned a return. The Trip 2 is barely meeting its operating costs and debt service payments that have been approved by the commission. And then the commission and Trip 2 discussed this in their brief, went beyond Trip 2 and looked at Trip 2's partners, because it had been argued that somehow Greenway is a cash cow and maybe Trip 2 doesn't have a return, but money's being diverted elsewhere. And the commission found, as it had in the past, that the Greenway's partners, the Trip 2's partners, have also never earned a positive return. And so that evidence supports the commission's finding with respect to assignment 4. So to close, the commission had the discretion to conclude the investigation without changing tolls. The commission made specific findings to support that decision, and those findings, in turn, are supported by evidence in the record. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Robert Roth of the law firm of Payne & Williams. I represent Toll Road Investors 2. Limited partnership in this action. Let me just try to make a couple of high-level brief points, and I'm happy to respond to any questions that you may have. But I think it's important when you decide this case to keep in mind the nature of the commission's proceeding below, because the appellant's argument here fundamentally misconceives what the commission was doing. Setting tolls is a legislative activity. Commission was making a legislative decision. It's like somebody goes to the General Assembly and says, I'd like you to set the speed limit on this road at 67 instead of 65. Somebody's got to make the decision whether 67 is better than 65. You can make arguments for either, perhaps. And what we've heard this morning is basically an argument that just says we disagree with the Commission's legislative decision. In 56542D, the General Assembly delegated to the Commission the authority to set the tolls for the Greenway. And then in 2008, as the Court has noted this morning, the General Assembly amended that delegation. The first delegation in subsection D said you are required to set the initial tolls, and those initial tolls have to be at a level that meets these three criteria that are in subsection D. But subsection D doesn't say that the commission is required to do anything else. And that's a fundamental problem with the appellant's argument. They argue under subsection D as if the commission had a duty to do something. The commission had no duty. What subsection D says, and let me be clear, we contend that subsection I precluded any action under subsection D. I'll get to that in about 30 seconds. But what subsection D says is after you are required to set those initial tolls, you may substitute new tolls upon a complaint, upon an application, upon your own initiative, after you conduct an investigation. You may set substitute tolls if those substitute tolls meet these three criteria. It doesn't say you have to set substitute tolls. So even if they'd investigated here and found that the existing tolls didn't meet those three criteria, the statute didn't require the commission to do anything at that point. All it said was, if you decide to do something, commission, then what you do has to meet these three criteria. Here the commission conducted an investigation. They did exactly what Delegate Ramadan asked them to do, if you look at his January letter. And they said, we've looked at whether the existing tolls meet those criteria. We find that they do. Those are factual findings. There was evidence in the record to support those findings. Loudoun County, Delegate Ramadan disagree with that evidence, but we have a case of conflicting evidence upon which the commission looked and made a legislative decision that we think this is the better way to go. Clearly, the record here supports that decision. But I'd like to get to subsection I, because I suggested to the court that even though you could affirm this case under either subsection D, because what the commission did procedurally was correct, you should affirm this case under subsection I.
Counsel, let me ask a question about D. Is there a period of time beyond which one can no longer challenge the toll? For example, if there's a toll set in 2012, is there a period of time where one has to challenge it, or does the ability to challenge it remain as long as the usership or the amount goes up or down?
Your Honor, if you wanted to challenge the specific commission decision, which was issued in 2007, you would have to act within the statutory time limit to appeal to this court. But anybody at any time can go to the commission and say, we want you to conduct an investigation and look at and consider setting new tolls. And you can do that at any time, assuming that subsection D still operates. Our contention here is that subsection D, between January 1, 2013 and January 1, 2020, was preempted by section I of the statute. And if you look at what happened here, it's pretty evident. In 2007, as the court has noted, the commission entered an order that said we're going to allow toll increases through 2012. And they did that under subsection D of the statute. In 2008, the very next year, the General Assembly passed subsection I. So the General Assembly knew what the commission had done. Obviously, it approved of what the rates, the tolls that the commission had set in place in 2007. And then the General Assembly reached this legislative compromise in I, and it said once that order ends, so beginning January 1, 2013, and that's why it starts that date, because the 2007 order raised tolls through 2012, beginning in 2013, the operator is guaranteed a toll increase. Guaranteed a toll increase under subsection I, number one, and number two. If the consumer price increase or the GDP rises,
which
or even if they don't rise,
it hardly makes sense increase. That there would be an automatic guarantee of a toll increase if there were no fixed toll base to be working from. Right? So your point is that I doesn't necessarily displace D. It presupposes the rate cannot be changed, the base rate cannot be changed, and the enhancements and the increasements in I will always be predicated upon that assumption. Am I understanding it right?
From 2013 to 2020,
right. And then
that's correct.
Then it drops off, and then D takes over from there on out.
Exactly. That's exactly the way it works. And again, what the General Assembly said General Assembly is looking at the 2007 order. And remember, this is the only road that's ever been built under this act. So when the General Assembly is looking at this act, it is looking at this road. And it says, in 2008, the year after the commission acts in 2007, we see these toll increases that go through 2012, and we're now going to guarantee that beginning in 2013, you're going to get increases that are going to be at least 2.8%, because remember, subsection I-1 says you get the increase in the GDP or the CPI or 2.8%, whichever is greater. You get an increase if there have been certain increases in property taxes. And then it said if you want, and in saying that, if you look at subsection I, it doesn't say anything there about the criteria in subsection D. It doesn't say you have to consider whether those increases are going to meet the criteria in subsection D. What it says in subparagraph I-3, if you want more than that automatic increase, you can apply for it, operator, but then you have to make your case. Then you have to show why you should get more, and in order to get more, you have to show that you meet those criteria. So we contend, Your Honor, that the language in subsection I is clear, that the General Assembly mandated these increases, and that you should act under subsection I in order to effect the intent of the General Assembly and to spare litigants in the future of having to go through a process like this.
Justice McClanahan has a question.
I'm sorry.
If we were to analyze it under D and using the standard of review for giving a presumption of correctness to the Commission's findings, aren't the findings in 22, 24, and 26 footnotes of the order sufficient to make the conclusion under D, or is there some other evidence in the record that would be required?
I think first of all, even under D, the commission wasn't required to make any change at all. And I think
you have to remember that.
If they were to make if you were just looking at whether the current tolls, which were then the January 2013 tolls, met the criteria in D, I think the findings in those footnotes are, in fact, sufficient to support the commission's findings.
Thank you very much. Call the next